everybody. What a week. What a last few weeks, really, when you look at things. And if you really take this one step farther, about the last year, we have seen so many changes. We have seen so many things that show that this nation and this world is in a state of collapse. The things that are wrong with this world are increasing exponentially. Anything from ISIS and some of what we saw with them, some of the ways that they're killing people are past cruel. They're hideous. They're horrible. A little over a week ago, in Charleston, South Carolina, 9 people died while they were in a Bible study because of a maniac. A person whose mind is so totally warped that he feels that the African American community shouldn't be here. And he wanted to show that in a very powerful way. It's galvanized the country in certain respects, in a positive way, but it also could have galvanized it in a negative way. We see the discontinuing of the use of the Confederate flag in many places, and that's going to continue to go. But now we have Louis Farrakhan saying, get rid of our flag, the United States flag. The stars and stripes, he wants it eliminated because he feels it's every bit as evil as the Confederate flag. Down in Cincinnati about a week ago, a policeman was murdered just for the sake of murdering him. They made a call and said there's a person with a gun out in the street. And it was that person who made the call. Several days later, when they get there, he goes and kills somebody who had been on the force for 27 years, a very, very highly decorated and respected person in that police department. The funeral was yesterday. Very, very emotional time in Cincinnati. Thursday, the Unaffordable Care Act was essentially reiterated as a part of this nation, leading us in another step toward socialism, what I lovingly call dictator care. And there's some reasons for that, which I won't get into here. And they're sitting there saying, now it should be called SCOTUS care, Supreme Court of the United States care, which there's a grain of truth to. And then yesterday. What can we say about yesterday? In my mind, yesterday, this is my opinion, keep this in mind. This is not doctrine or anything. We hit the point of no return. This nation will not be able to come back from that. This nation will not be able to come back from Obamacare. The disrespect shown to the police and to the authorities today. The killing of people just because they don't like their color or they don't like their belief. It's growing more and more rampant all the time. This world is collapsing upon itself. And not just with what happened with gay marriage yesterday. Matthew chapter 11. Christ talks about an area, a city. And I would like to today, for about the first half to two-thirds of this message, focus on that city and a person that was involved in that city. Starting in verse 20 of Matthew 11, it says, Then he began to rebuke the cities in which most of his mighty works had been done, because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in that day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, who are exalted to heaven, will be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. But I say to you, that it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. When you think about a city being compared to Sodom, and what Sodom means in Scripture, and what happened in Sodom, it's mind-numbing. And this world is going that direction. It may not quite be there yet, but it's awfully close. You'll see why I say that a little bit later. Luke chapter 17. The 17th chapter of Luke is another example where Christ references Sodom. And breaking into a thought in verse 26, says, "And as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage." Now here's something interesting. They married wives. The men married wives. They were given in marriage. "Until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all." So we see that Sodom was destroyed. They were living their day-to-day lives, but they were destroyed because of their sins, because their lifestyle had become so hideous that the only way to stop it was to destroy it, just like in the days of Noah. Continuing on, verse 30, "Even so, it will be in that day where the Son of Man is revealed. In that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back." Remember Lot's wife. We're going to look at that today. We're going to look at Lot. We're going to look at Lot's wife and see what happened there with the story of Sodom. But we're also going to look at another person, a person that Mr. Hemsley referenced in a sermon a few weeks ago, to see the other side of it, to see the way that we should be and the attitude that we should have. Let's first start out talking about Sodom and Lot. Genesis chapter 13. Lot comes on the scene at the end of chapter 11 of Genesis, and he's talked about as being a relation of Abraham. He was the son of Abraham's brother, and his brother died young, so Abraham kind of took him under wing. And he traveled with Abraham to the Promised Land, or back at that time, Abram, to the Promised Land. And in chapter 13, starting in verse 10, what has happened earlier in the chapter is that you have Lot and Abram and their goat herders and sheep herders and that starting to fight. And so they decided to separate. In verse 10, "Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go toward Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east." and they separated from each other. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. But the men of Sodom, verse 13, were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. Exceedingly wicked. We're not just talking wicked. Exceedingly. This is very wicked. And so we see this is a city that even back 20, 30 years before then, it really was very, very bad. That was a horrible city. Moving ahead a few chapters. In chapter 14, we find that Lot was captured and Abram went and saved him. Jumping ahead to chapter 18, we see where there were visitors to Abraham. And he was given that chance to talk to God in a very intimate and really a very interesting way. Starting in verse 16, Genesis 18. Then the men rose from there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on the way. And the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him, in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him." Now this was before his ultimate test by roughly 20 years to sacrifice Isaac. But God already knew a lot of very positive things about Abraham. Verse 20, Christ is confiding in Abraham something. And the Lord said, "Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me. And if not, I will know." So we see he's letting Abraham know that sentence is about to be passed on Sodom. The ensuing conversation between Abraham and Christ is fascinating. I'll paraphrase it some. Going to verse 23. Now, what happened is the other men went and Christ stayed up with Abraham. And verse 23, Abraham came near and said, "Would you destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" Can we approach God, Christ, with that type of boldness and ask a question like that? It's something to think about. That's the type of relationship we should have with Christ, where we can approach him boldly. It says, "Come boldly to the throne of grace." But we need to think about that. How bold are we when we come to Christ in prayer? Do we lay things on the line? Do we really just lay it out and say, "What about this?" We'll see another example coming up where somebody comes extremely boldly to God. And the Lord said, "If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all of the place for their sakes." Now over the next several verses, he works it down to 45, 40, 30, 20. And then finally, verse 32, Then he says, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak but once more. Suppose 10 should be found there. And he said, I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. So you think about, you find that Lot's family had 4. There were betrothed to the 2 daughters, so you could easily say 6. You only had to find 4 more people. Chapter 19. Now the 2 angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. Now, Lot sitting in the gate says something. He had not lived there for years and years. He'd maybe lived there at this point 20 years. And here he is sitting with the leaders of the community. So he had a good reputation. Keep that in mind with what's about to happen in the next few verses. He had a good reputation to be able to sit with the leaders and be respected by the leaders of the community. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. And he said, hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, then you may rise early and go on your way. Lot was hospitable. He'd never met these 2 people before, but I do suspect he had an idea that he was talking to 2 angels. I really strongly suspect that, but this was the way he normally was. This was a part of Lot's character, that he was outgoing, that he was caring. And that becomes important later on. Then the end of verse 2, it says, and they said, no, but we will spend the night in the open square. Now, with what's about to happen, wouldn't you say it's a good thing they did not spend the night in the open square? Remember, the sound of their cries had come to heaven. So they knew things weren't good there. And they were still willing to sit there. But watch Lot's response. But he insisted strongly, maybe even to a point to grabbing them and say, here, you've got to come into the house. Because Lot, I think, knew how bad things were. But he insisted, so they turned in to him and entered the house. Then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Now, this is a scripture that I wonder, was this during the days of unleavened bread? Was this possibly, taking it half a step farther, on the Passover? It's possible. Because normally, most of the year, you wouldn't eat unleavened bread. So this could be evidence that the holy days were in effect before Moses. Possible. It's not that strong, but it has some potential evidence. Verse 4, now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, and all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. So this is probably like in our time frame, 9:30 in the evening. Early evening, before you would go to bed. And they called to Lot in verse 5 and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally. Now, that wording doesn't say an awful lot to people. Carnally. There's some other translations that I think give it a little bit more oomph than that. The New American Standard says, bring them out to us that we may have relations with them. The NIV says, bring them out to us so we can have sex with them. Blunt. These people just come into the community. Literally as guests. The Living Bible's even stronger. Bring out these men to us so we can rape them. Which actually is closer to the right translation. Assault them. Hurt them. possibly kill them. This city, and this is why I say we're not quite there yet. Because they don't have, you don't have somebody, a stranger, come to somebody's house and people surround the house and say that I want to do that to somebody. You don't have it quite to that point yet. It's getting there. But it's not quite there. It's close. And don't be surprised if some things like that start happening soon. Continuing on back in chapter 19, verse 6. Then Lot went out to them through the doorway, shut the door behind him, which is a big mistake. He's out there now by himself, confronting these people. And he said, "Please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly. See now, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Please, let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you wish. Only do nothing to these men, since this is the reason they have come under the shadow of my roof." Why would he offer his daughters? There's something odd there. Is it possible that these men were so depraved that they had absolutely no interest in women? Only men. That would be the only logical reason I could think of him offering something like that. That they don't want the women, they want the men. I mean, that to me, I see that passage, and then with a passage that's coming up, my wife and I were talking about this. How could Lot be called righteous? Making an offer like that. But there is a little bit of an explanation. Verse 9, and they said, "Stand back." Then they said, "This one came in to stay here, and he keeps acting as a judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." He was probably going to die. I think that would be pretty safe to say. Deal worse with him than with the angels. So they pressed hard against the man Lot and came near to break down the door, but the men reached out their hands and pulled Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they became weary trying to find the door. So they were all blind. They couldn't see anything. They couldn't find the door. They couldn't find the handle. They wouldn't be able to unlock it. So then, after a while, they left. Verse 12, then the men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else here, son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in the city? Take them out of this place. Get out of here. They've seen what they wanted to see, that it was as bad as what they had heard. Maybe even worse. Verse 13, for we will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who'd married his daughters and said, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But to his son-in-laws, he seemed to be joking. They didn't take him seriously. And this was a son-in-law in a betrothal stage because the girls had not been with a man yet. Verse 15, when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." Verse 16, and while he, Lot, lingered. Why would he want to linger? He's being told the city's about to be destroyed. He lingered. The men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him out and set him outside the city. So they took him by his hand and walked him out of the city. He didn't want to go. And we will see in a few minutes, his wife even more so didn't want to go. Verse 17, so it came to pass when they had brought them outside that he said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. The next few verses, Lot talks them and allow them to go to this little town on the edge of the plain. Verse 23, the sun had risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. Then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. So he overthrew those cities, all the plains, all the inhabitants of the city, and what grew on the ground. Totally destroyed. Verse 26, but his wife looked back behind him, or even behind her, and she became a pillar of salt. The New Unger's Bible Dictionary talks about Sodom a little bit, and I do want to read this to you. It is a town of the patriarchal age, which is the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, located in the plain or valley of the Jordan, together with its sister cities, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboam, and Zoar. The Bible notes that the district of the Jordan where these cities were located was exceedingly fertile and well-populated at about 2065 B.C., but that not long afterwards was abandoned, which is in full accord with archaeological evidence. Scholars used to place these cities north of the Dead Sea, but now it's generally agreed they were situated in the Valley of Siddim, and this was the area at the southern end of the Dead Sea, now covered with water. So these cities now are under the Dead Sea. One thing to explain with that region and is that it is actually on a fault line. The Jordan River, the Dead Sea, the Red Sea, down through there is a major fault line, almost like the San Andreas. They don't get as many earthquakes there as the San Andreas does. But when they get them, they get big ones. Now, the thing that becomes interesting with that, too, is Jerusalem's only about 20 miles from that fault line. So when you think about prophecy and the fulfillment of prophecy, a great earthquake, there could be the place that God uses to trigger it, is along the Jordan, down through the Dead Sea. Continuing. Sometime around the middle of the 21st century B.C., this region with its cities was overwhelmed by a great fire. The area is said to have been full of tar pits. Now stop and think about that for a minute. Tar pits. Nick, I'm sure you saw the La Brea tar pits in Los Angeles. I've seen pictures of it. I've seen some things. I've never actually been to the La Brea pits. But needless to say, they can catch fire very easily. And it will smoke and smolder for a long time when you get tar on fire. Bitumen deposits are still to be found in this locality. The entire valley is on a long fault line that forms the Jordan Valley, the Dead Sea, and the Arabah. An earthquake-ridden region through its history, geological activity was doubtless an accompanying factor in the destruction of the cities, although the Bible account records only the miraculous elements. The salt and free sulfur of this area, now a burned-out region of oil and asphalt, was apparently mingled by an earthquake, and this is his theory here, and I will say that, but it does make sense. God can't easily just sit there and send it from heaven, but if you see something like this happen, and you're shooting stuff up 40, 50,000 feet into the air, it's sure going to look like it's coming from heaven, doesn't it? God can easily use the things that are a part of this earth and do what he wants done. And I want to say that going into this. The salt and free sulfur of this area, now burned out region of oil and asphalt, was apparently mingled by an earthquake causing a violent explosion carried up into the air red hot. The exploding salt and sulfur literally caused a rain of fire and brimstone over the whole plain. So, either way, God did it. Whether you believe it literally came down from heaven or whether it was an explosion on the earth that shot sulfur and fire and brimstone thousands and thousands of feet into the air. Either way, God did it. He's the one who made the decision, and it happened. The account of Lot's wife being turned into a pillar of salt is frequently connected with the great salt mass in the valley called by the Arabs Jebel Uzdam, that is the mountain of Sodom. There is a hill some 5 miles long stretching north to south at the southwest end of the Dead Sea, somewhere under the slowly rising waters of the southern part of the lake. In this generally locality, the cities of the valley are probably to be found. In classical and New Testament times, their ruins were still visible, not yet being covered with water. Now, the Dead Sea is the lowest place on the earth, about 1,300 feet below sea level. And that area is still sinking into the earth, the south end of the Dead Sea, where Sodom and Gomorrah and these cities all were. I think God did a pretty good job in destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, regardless of the way he chose to do it. Verse 27. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. Then he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land, which went up like the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had dwelt. So Abraham knew what the sentence was when he saw the fire and the smoke the next day. He knew there were not 10 righteous. There weren't 5. You had 4 leave the city, but only 3 got to the mountains. Lot's wife looked back. Lot didn't want to leave, but he didn't look back. How do we look at our past? Now, there's nothing wrong with learning from our past. But do we look back lovingly on our past, pre-Christian, especially, and wish things were the way they were back then? Or do we look ahead, look forward to the potential of what God has for each and every one of us? That we have the potential of being His sons, His daughters, and helping all of the universe. All of this earth first, and then who knows after that, throughout the universe, as children of God. 2 Peter chapter 2. We find in 2 Peter chapter 2 another reference to Sodom. Starting in verse 4 of 2 Peter 2, it says, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of 8 people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example of those who afterwards would live ungodly." So Sodom and Gomorrah, the reason this happened is as an example. To see what happens if we become so depraved that we essentially are totally against the way of God. Continuing, verse 7. And delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man, which I asked that question earlier, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. He saw what was going on there, but he was willing to live there. He was willing to some degree compromise. He moved into Sodom after living out on the plain away from the city for a while, probably found it a little bit easier to live in the city than living in the plain. But he compromised. But he was righteous. But you can see, even in that righteousness, he was reluctant to leave the city, even when he knew it was going to be destroyed. Continuing, verse 9, that the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations. He delivered Lot out of that temptation, didn't he? And the daughters. And to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. And especially those who walk according to flesh in their lusts of uncleanness and despise authority. Going back to something in the introduction there. The way the police are treated anymore, the way that leaders are treated anymore, in many places, there isn't any respect. It's like Rodney Dangerfield, there's no respect. So we see this world just becoming more and more like what Peter just talked about here. Becoming more and more what was talked about in Genesis. Jude. I can say chapter 1 because there's only one chapter. Verse 5. But I want to remind you, though you once knew this, that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. And that's going to come into play here in a minute. That reference. And the angels who did not keep their proper domain but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. As Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them in a similar manner to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. This is one of the scriptures that there are a couple of new translations that are about to come out that they are eliminating. They are eliminating any reference to homosexuality in some of the new translations. Totally against what it says in the 22nd chapter of Revelation about not adding to or taking away from this book. So we see where things are going when it comes to that. There's a term called sodomy. And I want to briefly cover it before we go into the next section. The term sodomy refers to homosexual activities of men in the story of the city of Sodom in the Bible. And that's where sodomy came from, was the reference back to Sodom. The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah because of the residents' immorality became a central part of Western attitudes toward forms of non-procreative sexual activity and same-sex relations. So there's actually two parts to this, as we will see in a minute. Beginning with Illinois in 1961, state legislatures re-examined their sodomy statutes. 27 states repealed these laws, usually as a part of a general revision of the criminal code, and with the recognition that heterosexuals engage in the same type of sexual activities that homosexuals do. I'll leave it at that. I won't get into too much depth on that. In addition, state courts in 10 states applied state constitutional provisions to invalidate sodomy laws. As of early 2003, 8 states had law that barred homosexual and heterosexual sodomy. 3 other states barred sodomy between homosexuals. Now, one other thing, the Supreme Court ruled that sodomy laws were unconstitutional in 2003, at the end of 2003. Ironically, there are still adultery laws in the books. But you can't have laws against sodomy anymore. But sodomy can be between a man and a woman, a man and a man, a woman and a woman, where the intent is not for procreation, or using places where you can't procreate from is probably a more appropriate way of explaining it. With that, we were just talking a minute ago about what happened in the rebellion that Mr. Hemsley spoke on a little bit several weeks ago. And I want to get into that in a little bit more detail and a specific person related to that. Numbers chapter 13. There were 12 spies that were sent out to spy out what became the nation of Israel. One of those men was named Caleb. So I'd like to take the rest of the time today and talk about this man and the things we can learn from him. So far, it's been kind of a dark sermon, but there is something we can very, very definitely learn from Caleb as to how to handle this situation that we don't learn from Lot. Because Lot seemed to be willing to compromise a little bit. Starting in verse 26 of Numbers 13, it says, "Now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation, showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told him and said, 'We went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan.'" Verse 30 shows something about Caleb. "Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, 'Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it.'" Supreme confidence in God, that God would keep his promise and bring them into that land. Caleb didn't forget the promises that were made in Egypt to the people. Verse 31. "But the men who had gone up with them said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.' And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, 'The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature.'" Now, the Canaanites and some of the others, they may have been a little bit taller, but they weren't like me standing next to Shaquille O'Neal by any stretch of the imagination. You know, 5'7" versus 7'1", or Manute Bol, who's 7'7". You know, it wouldn't be like that. They may have been 6 foot or something like that. The typical person in that day was somewhere around 5. Typical man was probably about my height, or a little bit shorter back in those days. So, I mean, you're not all the men in Canaan were of great stature. "Then we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight." Now, Mr. Hemsley got into that in pretty good detail, so I won't. I will say the descendants of Anak were generally about 8 to 9 feet tall. So, I mean, if you look at yourself as a grasshopper, you know, if you think if you're 5'6" and you're a grasshopper next to 8 to 9 feet, so be it. I'd just say I'm like a little, I'm like, what's that show, Little People, Big World, where they have the short people that are doing things in a house, and they have to climb on stuff all over the place to be able to get the shelves up high and things like that. And it'd be like them with a normal person. So, I mean, they weren't midgets by any stretch. They weren't grasshoppers. They were a lot shorter. If you look at David and Goliath, if Goliath was 9 feet, David may have been 5'6". That's 2.5 feet. That's not a grasshopper to a human. So they were blowing it up, making a huge story of it. Chapter 14, verse 1. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt. If only we had died in this wilderness. Why had the Lord... Now, there's a real irony. If only we had died in this wilderness. Isn't there an irony to that? What happened to them? They died in that wilderness. They got what they wanted. Why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. And Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. Tearing clothes is a sign of mourning. Job tore his clothes when he lost everything in the second chapter of Job. That was how they mourned. They would take their clothes and they would tear them off as a part of their mourning process. In a lot of respects, I'm thankful we don't do that anymore, because we'd go through an awful lot of clothing, wouldn't we? You know, that would be, that could get very expensive after a while. Verse 7, and they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, the land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. You hear that with Rahab. I believe second chapter of Joshua, when she protected the spies. And she said they were afraid, that their strength was out of them. And this was what they were saying. When they see us, their strength will be out of them. We will take over the land. But you essentially had four people against hundreds of thousands. That's pretty bad odds, isn't it? If you're in a fight. Four against, let's even say, 100,000. Not good odds of winning, is it? But they had somebody behind them. Verse 10, and the congregation said to stone them with stones. And then God steps on the scene. And he says to Moses, I'm going to destroy these people. And I'm going to paraphrase this dramatically. I will destroy these people and make from you a great nation. And Moses talked to him the same way Abraham talked to God. Many of the great men in Scripture could talk to God with great power and great confidence. And that's some of the reason they were the great men in the Bible, because they could go to God that way. And that's what we need to be able to do. For the sake of time, I'm going to jump ahead to verse 20. I will suffice to say that he did relent from destroying them right then and there, but he did set the punishment up. In verse 20, he said, then the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men who have seen my glory and signs, which I did in Egypt, and in the wilderness and put me to the test now these 10 times, which Mr. Hemsley hit a few weeks ago. The 10 times have not heeded my voice. They certainly shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him, kind of indicates he may have had God's spirit in him. Because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully. Now I want you to notice at this point, one person isn't mentioned here. Only Caleb is mentioned here. Joshua is not mentioned here. Only Caleb. Because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it. Caleb was bold. Even in the previous chapter when he spoke with power. He probably is the one who spoke in chapter 14, but it indicates that Joshua may have been in on that too. But he spoke with power. He spoke with confidence. Jumping ahead to verse 30. Now here, it says, except for Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun, you shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in. So there he adds Joshua. But he made a very special promise to Caleb because of how bold he was in what he said. Numbers chapter 32. Just a few pages back in verse 11. Numbers 32. Surely none of the men who came up from Egypt from 20 years old and above shall see the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun, for they have wholly followed the Lord. Because they totally obeyed the Lord through this time in the wilderness, they were allowed to enter the promised land. Numbers 34, I will just reference that very quickly. Numbers 34, in verse about 19, it talks about the men who were appointed to divide the land. And Caleb was the appointee from the tribe of Judah to divide the land of the tribe of Judah amongst the families. So he had an important responsibility even with that. Joshua chapter 14. This is about the time when Israel had pretty well taken over the land of Canaan. And now, Caleb says something to Joshua. He respects him as a leader, very much in the way he says this. But he says, starting in verse 6, then the children of Judah came to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, said to him, you know the word which the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, showing great respect to Moses. When it was somebody who was dead and they really respected the person, they would call him a man of God. Concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea, I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought back word to him as it was in my heart. That says something. It was in his heart. When you look at the first great commandment, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all of your soul, and with all of your mind, and with all of your strength, according to where you go in the New Testament. Continuing on, verse 8. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. God was an integral part of him. Lord my God. And he really emphasized that. That is, that God was his God. Nevertheless, verse 8, my brethren who went up with me, verse 9, so Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the land where your foot is trodden shall be your inheritance and your children's forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord, here again, my God. And now, behold, the Lord has kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years. So he's 85 years old now. Okay, we have a few people in here who are in that age bracket. Ever since the Lord spoke this word to Moses while Israel wandered in the wilderness, and now here I am this day, 85 years old. And yet I am as strong this day as on the day that Moses sent me. How many of us are going to be as strong as we were at 85 years old as we were at 40? I don't think I will be. Unless I'm healed of some things. I am as strong this day as on the day that Moses sent me. Just as my strength was then, so now is my strength for war, both for going out and for coming in. Now therefore give me this mountain of which the Lord spoke in that day. For you heard in that day how the Anakim were there, and that the cities were great and fortified. It may be that the Lord will be with me. And he says, maybe. He knows he will be, but he words it as maybe, just in a form of respect. And I shall be able to drive them out as the Lord said. What confidence. Now, a key to this comes in the next few verses. And Joshua blessed him and gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, as an inheritance. Hebron therefore became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord God of Israel. And the name of Hebron formerly was Kirjath Arba. Now, there's one more thing to bring into this. Judges chapter 1, excuse me. Judges chapter 1, verse 12. Then Caleb said, whoever attacks Kirjath Sefer and takes it, to him I will give my daughter Achish, his wife. And Othniel. Now Othniel, this was the first of the judges that are talked about in the book of Judges. The son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it, so he gave him his daughter Achish as wife. Going down to verse 20, I find this fascinating. And they gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said, then he expelled from there the three sons of Anak, the giants, the 9-foot-tall people. He expelled them. It's almost like he wanted Hebron so that he could do that himself. What confidence in God that God would give him the strength to expel those people, expel those giants out of that city, and that city became his. What strength? I'd like to read something about Caleb. And in the Bible I have, they have some general commentary about a lot of the people. And what they say about Caleb is just fascinating. And I love the way it's worded, and I think it's very appropriate as we start to wrap up the message today. The voice of the minority is not often given a hearing. Nevertheless, truth cannot be measured by numbers. On the contrary, it often stands against majority opinion. Doesn't this sound familiar? Very familiar. Truth remains unchanged because it is guaranteed by the character of God. God is truth, What he says is the last word. At times, a person must even stand alone on the side of truth. Caleb was not so much a man of great faith as a man of faith in a great God. He knew what God could do. He had full confidence that he would keep the promise that was given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he kept that in the forefront of his mind. He made it an integral part of himself, in his heart, in his soul, in his mind, and all he did rotated around that promise. Continuing. His boldness rested on his understanding of God, not on his confidence in Israel's ability to conquer the land. He could not agree with the majority, for that would be to disagree with God. He stood up for what he believed. We are in a spot right now in this country where our beliefs are being attacked on every side. Do we have the strength of Caleb to keep our focus? He focused on the promised land, a physical promised land. We focus on a spiritual promised land. We focus on the kingdom of God and the words of Christ and how he wants us to live and show that love first to him, but not only to him, but to all of humanity. Whether they're homosexual or heterosexual, whether they're whatever. I don't know what to call Caitlyn Jenner. You know, that's one of those things. I'm not sure how you're even supposed to respond to that, because not a true she, not a true he. And if you use it, you're probably in even more trouble yet. But we are looking for our promised land. And we need to keep our focus and recognize that, like Mr. Armstrong said, we know how it ends and we win. So let us stay focused. Let us keep our focus on God, on his way, on his plan for us and for this entire world, that we may show love in the way that we believe, not only to God, but show really a true love to humanity. In that, in time, when we are kings, priests, sons, and daughters of God, that we are able to help them reach their full potential.